My name's Richard Broom, and I'd like to welcome you to History AAH. I wanted to talk today first off about historians, Aborigines in Australia, and to give a lecture to introduce the notion of Aboriginal history and to give you some of the origins of the way Europeans have talked about Aboriginal people, and I'll then be moving to how they're beginning to talk with Aboriginal people. So I want to open it with reading a section from a novel published in 1955. It goes like this. A cart drove between two big stringy barks and stopped. These were the dominant trees in that part of the bush, rising above the involved scrub with a simplicity of true grandeur. So the cart stopped, grazing the hairy side of a tree, and the horse, shaggy and stolid, as the tree sighed and took root. The man who sat in the cart got down. He rubbed his hands together because already it was cold, a curdle of cold cloud in a pale sky and copper in the west. On the air you could smell the frost. Then the man took an axe and struck at the side of a hairy tree, more to hear the sound than for any other reason, and the sound was cold and loud. The man struck at the tree and struck till several white chips had fallen. He looked at the scar in the side of the tree. The silence was immense. It was the first time anything like this had happened in that part of the bush. The man made a lean-to with bags and a few saplings. He built a fire. He sighed at last because the lightning of his small fire had kindled in him the first warmth of content, of being somewhere. That particular part of the bush had been made his by the entwining fire. It licked at and swallowed the loneliness. Not a bad start to a novel, is it? Can anyone tell me which novel it is?
Is it The Tree of Man?
It is The Tree of Man by Patrick White. Some people still say Australia's greatest novelist. He wrote that in 1955. He was awarded a Nobel Prize in Literature in the early 1970s and went on to write 12 novels in his career. It's a marvellous book, and I hope one long holidays you'll sit down and read along with Stan Parker and his wife-to-be and read about their pioneering. It's a great opening to a wonderful novel, but I guess you should ask, is it good history? Was this the first time that this had ever happened in the bush? And White says it was the first time. And Stan Parker makes the place his by the rituals of possession, the chopping at the tree, the entwining fire that bonds him with the land. Even his root, his horse is taking root in the ground. This is an act of possession by Stan Parker. But of course, we know that he's possessing somebody else's land. So Aboriginal people have been silenced by that marvellous opening in the novel, and they don't appear from my memory, and it's a long time ago that I read it. I don't think they appear in the novel. So that their ownership of the land, their possession of the land, has been silenced by this novel. And this is a story that's been told countless times in accounts of first European settlement, usually called first settlement. And so Aboriginal people have been often silenced from the story. And so there is the PowerPoint, but I kept it back from you because I wanted to see who might know that that was the Tree of Man. Now, this wasn't always the case, and if you look at some of the early ethnographies, for instance, James Cook's journals of his first voyaging, the first Englishman to voyage up the east coast of Australia, he wrote about Aboriginal people, and he eventually took possession at Possession Island in 1770. Now, Cook didn't silence Aborigines from his journal, from his story, but he figured them in certain ways. He said that there were few of them, and yet he didn't really know because he was only coasting up the edge of Australia most of the time, looking and seeing fires and perhaps some figures on the beach. He said that they were uninterested in trade as a people because when he left some trinkets in an Aboriginal camp in Botany Bay, just south of Sydney, they were still there when he returned 2 days later. So he said this is a people uninterested in trade. And he observed from what he could see of their society that they are a people with no built environment, no houses. They didn't seem to have structures of leadership from the meetings he had with them up at the Endeavour River. So they were a people that were have-nots, no houses, no chiefs, possibly no religion. But of course, at least Cook was challenged by an Indigenous challenge. And two men came down on the beach at Botany Bay and they tried to warn off the rowboat containing Cook, who was trying to make his first landfall on Botany Bay. And Sidney Parkinson, one of the artists on the Cook voyage, took that image, and we still have it today to see Aboriginal action, Aboriginal resistance to a landing. So what I want to talk about now is that we should remember all the time when we're doing this subject, AAH, that knowledge is a constructed thing. That Aborigines, in a sense, are an invented people. They are invented by the Europeans. There might be somewhere down the back. They are invented by Europeans. Even the name Aborigines is given to them by the Europeans. And their characteristics, which often fill early writings, are characteristics that Europeans place upon them from limited knowledge. And I think we'll see this as we go through. So that travellers, explorers, later missionaries and government officials make knowledge about Aboriginal people. And they make knowledge that one historian has called this is Aboriginalism. And he's taking that from Edward Said's notion that of Orientalism, where people have a perception of the Orient from the Occident and they make knowledge about them. So he's applied this and reminding us that everything we read in this subject is, in the early stages at least, created knowledge by Europeans. And so you've got to ask yourselves, why is this so? Why are people making knowledge? And often it's because of a position of self-interest. They're seeking to have control over Aboriginal people. Because if you make knowledge about someone, you actually start to set the agenda about them. You start to control them by saying, this is how they are. And of course, this word gets out. It's these words are sent back to England. They are put into books. And we can still read the books today. So therefore, we have to always deconstruct these words and to realise that they were made in a particular context, in a particular time, for a particular reason. Even Aboriginality, people's own identity, has been defined for them through Acts of Parliament, which actually set out who was an Aboriginal person and who was not. So people's very identity has been defined for them. And so you can see how the power of knowledge is as pervasive, as deep as any physical power over people. And just when we talk in this subject, we use various terms for people. Remember again that the term Aboriginal, like the earlier term Native, or the term Indigenous, is a term that is coming from a European language and a European perspective. And these terms arose in colonial times. These terms, Aboriginal, Indigenous, was an attempt to have a continent-wide term. But we, of course, are dealing with probably 400 to 500 different cultures in Aboriginal society. Of course, they are variations on a theme, but they are nonetheless variations. And all those people have their own words for themselves, and we should remember that. Even, you might know the word Koori, used today, is still a regional word. And not all people who live in the southeast of Australia like to be called Koori. Some Indigenous people say, no, I don't like the word Koori. Most people now accept it. But up in the north, if you call someone a Koori, they'll say, no, I'm a Murray. Or if you call them a Koori over in the west, they'll say, no, I'm Noongar. Or up in Arnhem Land, they'll say, no, I'm Yolngu. So that they have their own regional words. So when we're writing history, I think it would be best if you can try and use the people's words that they used of themselves at the time. So I don't use Koori when I'm writing about the 19th century because it didn't exist. It was a word that emerged in the 1950s and 60s that the people used for themselves, actually imported from New South Wales. So I try to use the words that the people call themselves, like in around this area, Warrong or Wurundjeri or Bunurong. These are the words they used then and use now. Or sometimes they might take on new identities, like they might call themselves Corindirk people, and that was a mission. And they will have several identities, as we do ourselves. We call ourselves Melbourneites or Victorians or Australians or whatever. So just think about the words you use when you're writing. Now I want to talk about four phases of writing Aboriginal history. And they have been basically talking about Aborigines, talking for Aborigines, talking with, and then finally listening to Aboriginal people. And I think that the first two phases in particular are the ones I have opened up with, people talking about Aborigines, making knowledge about them. And the way to escape that Aboriginalism, if you like, is to, I think, apply those three ways of escaping talking about others. That is, be reflexive, be self-critical about what's going on. Remember that these are always words used by colonisers for particular reasons. Often they want to put down Aboriginal people. And we'll discuss that as this subject goes on. Why do they want to do that? How do they put them down? Well, they can call them natives or cannibals or, you know, a whole range of ways they can do it. So be self-critical about this. And always remember that often the historians have to resist some of the things they're reading because they are from other places and other times with certain agendas. And so they need to recognise that perhaps these are the words of the winners. And maybe we also need to listen to the words of the people that aren't winning at any particular time in history. So to be a bit oppositional to the dominant discourses that we're given. And also, historians, I think, have to move to being cooperative. That is, cooperative with Aboriginal people, to talk with them about the histories they want presented and to get their perspectives into that history making. So let's pursue this a bit more. Let's pursue talking about Aborigines. This mode usually occurs in a colonial context. And the colonists, the European colonists, were fascinated by Aboriginal people, fascinated by the cultural difference, by the ways that they saw as quaint or weird or different or just mind-boggling. For instance, nakedness, you know, was something that people didn't experience in European society. Indigenous people often are partly or fully naked. This was actually just astounding to the locals. So there was a whole range of things in this society that fascinated them. And they don't, in the early stages, stop talking about Aboriginal people in their journals and their early diaries. And they write lots about them because they want to know who these people are, how are they different from European people, how does hunting and gathering work, how do these people survive in this environment? You know, they didn't understand that, so it sort of fascinated, intrigued, repulsed them all at once. Secondly, I think the settlers were trying to define themselves. And they were confronted by another group of people and they had to see in what ways they were same and different to these people. And of course, the settlers were in a new place themselves. Who were they as colonials? They weren't now from the mother country. They had branched off. They were becoming something else. So that their whole identity was at stake. And the way we form our identities is that we shape our identity through having a view of ourselves, but also a view of who we are not. You know, we're not like that person. I'm good at sport, they're not good at sport. You know, I'm a sports person. So you define yourself against these opposites as well that you perceive, as well as how you are yourself. And I think also the colonists had a strong sense of duty. Sometimes it might have been guilt, sometimes a sense of duty, but they were very aware that they were interlopers, that they were not the original owners, and that they were using the land of others. And so they developed a strong sense of duty. And Westgarth, who was one of the early writers of history in Victoria, he wrote a book called Australia Felix, 1848, he had this to say in that book, in their own limited sphere, he's talking about the Aborigines, they have enjoyed a happiness until disturbed by our restless progress. It is now our duty to save and assist the wrecks which our colonising enterprise have created. So he has a strong sense that Aboriginal life has been changed by the European presence and he owes some sort of duty. But of course, this view isn't sustained for too long. And Westgarth, his interest wanes in Aboriginal people. If you look at his first book, he's writing 40 pages about Aboriginal culture, what the people looked like, how they dressed, what they did, how they ate, what buildings or whatever they slept in. He's trying to get to know these people, making knowledge about them. But by the sort of second or third edition of his book, he's writing only about 10 pages on them. And I think this is because one sense, the different has become less novel and less fascinating, but also he's starting to make comparisons. And by 1864, the Maori wars have been fought in New Zealand. The Maori actually fought so hard that they defeated some British troops on a number of occasions and caused considerable anxiety within the British Empire, because the Maori were a warlike people. Over many centuries, they had developed a warrior class and a specialised culture, and they had villages with fortifications, etc. So compared to them, the Aboriginal people don't seem to be putting up the same sort of fight, and therefore this leads to a lesser admiration for them in the eyes of Westgarth and quite a lot of others. Of Aborigines, he says, it would be almost seem as if it was an immutable law of nature that such an inferior dark race should disappear. So he's already saying that by 1864, talking about the doomed race theory. And so as the interest in them declines, so does the writing of them. And so a portrait of savagery emerges and a race that is doomed. And if you I'll just go on a bit more on that before I go there. If you look at Westgarth a little bit more, he actually does depict them very, very strongly in terms of savagery. And he talks about them practicing cannibalism and infanticide, which are two of the great human taboos, that you eat others and you eat your children. Now, what is interesting is that infanticide was happening in London at the same time. Women were, because of various circumstances, killing babies or leaving them abandoned. Now, this wasn't discussed in a comparative way. Westgarth was only focusing in on Aboriginal practices of infanticide, for instance. And cannibalism is a very interesting issue in that mostly it's built on little evidence, colonial rumour, and colonial fears go in very much to the discussion of Aboriginal cannibalism. So it's you can see that he's trying to talk about Aboriginal society in a way that's completely making them other to European society and very different. Now, the next book I want to talk about was around on the shelves for a very long time. It was Ernest Scott's Short History of Australia, and it was in print for 50 years, probably the publishing sensation of the historical world in Australia. Not bad being in print for 60 years. Scott was a professor of history, the first in Australian history at Melbourne University. He was also a journalist, and he started off as a Hansard reporter of Parliament. And he wrote this this history, and it goes through 22 reprints and is able to be bought up till 1964. And his story is one of the making of Australian democracy and progress. And even if you go to his opening chronology, you can see that his first opening is 1486, Diaz rounds the Cape of Good Hope. So his chronology is a chronology of exploration, of European expansionism from the West. And that is the way he configures the story of Australia. It's Australia, a story of European penetration, then the progress to a nation and a glorious Commonwealth. Now, he does write a little bit about Aboriginal people, but he sees them as painted savages. He talks about William Dampier's dismal view of them, written in the 1690s, of those in Western Australia. He says Aboriginal people are too low in the scale of civilisation to barter and to be interested in trade, so he's picking up on Cook's view of them. And he says even the making of a bow was beyond them. So he has a very dismal view of Aboriginal people, which of course is in print for a long time in the early 20th century in Australia. He talks about the Black War in Tasmania being an extermination. He says they were victims of a grim and hateful episode in Australia's history, but it was an inevitable process. So again, he has the view that this was bound to happen. History makes this happen. When an advanced people, in his view, meets an Indigenous people, there is going to be one outcome only. And so the only mention of Aboriginal people in that book is that they were there on the frontier and then they disappear from his story of Australia, because he doesn't see them as progressive. They are the old Australia that inevitably has to be overrun by the rest. Now, there's other great sources you can, as historians, use, and this is a terrific source I have. It's actually my brother's. He lives in Ballarat. Please don't tell him I've got it, because I don't think he knows. This was the Children's Australian Encyclopedia. It was put out by the Sanitarium Company that make Weet-Bix and all the other great breakfast foods, the healthy ones. And it looked like this, and if you ate your Weet-Bix up fast, you got a swap card in the bottom of the pack, and you could put the swap card in the spot. Now, I was very interested in this because, as my next slide will show you, it was an extremely popular thing. And I just skipped over that. I might go back to that, but I'll move on. They sold 600,000 copies of this at a time when the Australian population was about 5 or 6 million. So something like one in five households had a Weet-Bix children's sanitarium, because they were cheap. They were dirt cheap. Most of us ate Weet-Bix in the 1950s and 60s and 40s, and you just ate it up and slapped in another swap card. Now, the Aboriginal entry in this is on the first page, but they get the first column here, they do not get a swap card, although wattle, acacia, gets a swap card, probably because it's going to be nice and yellow on the front page and really colourful. And so if you read this account, you'll see that Aboriginal people are said to be the oldest people extant, and that they basically were like Europeans 5,000 years ago. So it's figuring them as primitive, as the oldest people extant, says they haven't developed because there had been a lack of wild animals and things in Australia and they haven't been challenged. And it only goes on for about that much in the book. And it sort of, I think, it comes out of the view of primitivism that's very strong at that time. There was another version of the card. In 1946, there was a second version brought out like that, and that has another entry on Aboriginal people. And this time, there is a swap card associated with their entry, and it's very interesting. They start to give a different perspective. They give a lot of an anthropological background to the people, saying there are 500 tribes across Australia, and they have various different languages, and talks a bit about their technology, etc. But the entry actually then shifts to telling us about Daisy Bates, who was quite an interesting European woman who went and lived in the desert down on the in South Australia at Uldea, and she looked after Aboriginal people for about 20 years. She used to traipse around in long dresses and things right up to her neck and hats to stop the sun getting to her. Very prim English woman, but she did things for Aboriginal people when others were doing nothing. But of course, it was a very paternalistic act by her, and the story of Aborigines swings to telling the story of her, and of course, the image is of Daisy Bates ministering lovingly to Aboriginal people. So it still says at the end that they are a dying race. This is in 1946. And this is when there's 2,000 Aboriginal people going off to war to fight as part of Australian forces, and yet this entry still shows them as primitive people who are to be a dying race. So you can see that images are very long-standing in Australia. And I would suspect that our Prime Minister might have had the children's encyclopedia in his room, because, you know, I'm sure he was eating well up there in Erwood. It was only a few suburbs away from me. We certainly had it in our household. And the thing is, when I found this book in my papers a few years ago, I opened it up and all the images flooded back into my mind. The images put into these books have a lot of indelible force, and therefore are very powerful. So while ever it's a children's encyclopedia, it's actually, I think, having a strong influence. So that's why, as a historian, I think we need to look at those sorts of sources, encyclopedias, children's books, etc., etc., to see how things are being formed. Now, so there's obviously a discourse shift going on. The second encyclopedia is more up to date. It's got more anthropological knowledge in there. It's more positive about Aboriginal people, but it's still ending up with the sting that they are still a dying people. And that's, for those who didn't see up the back, that's the front page of the second one. Now, there is a shift at this time. You can detect it in these two children's encyclopedias. There's a shift in the discourse, and I think it's for a number of reasons. First of all, the experience of Nazi Germany, I think, alerts many people to the power of racism and racial images and their dreadful power as the knowledge of the Holocaust unfolds. So there's, I think, quite a strong development of anti-racial thinking in the 1950s. Also, the Japanese expansionism throughout Asia has disrupted a whole lot of colonial powers, and in fact, many of them don't get re-established. So there's a decolonisation movement that is sprouted partly by the impact of war, but also things like the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which puts out a different vision of human rights and rights of peoples to run their own lives. And so this unleashes forces. And for instance, Indigenous and Third World voices start to emerge. In 1955, there was a very important conference in Bandung in Indonesia, which brought together about 30 African and Asian peoples to talk about their future. And they defined a different approach from the Cold War. Because at that time in the 1950s, the Cold War was emerging with America and Russia trying to carve off spheres of influence. And these 30 people at Bandung said, we won't be aligned with either side. And they formed a third bloc of non-aligned Indigenous and Third World countries to forge their own sort of view. So these are large global forces which start, I think, to shift the way people in Australia and historians in particular talk about Aboriginal people. For instance, if you take Crawford's History, Australia, 1952. Crawford, again, another professor of Australian history at Melbourne University. Melbourne really is the powerhouse of history making in Australia. You should know that, so you're really lucky to be studying history in a place like Melbourne. For a long time, it has been a powerhouse of history making. And Crawford was a very humane man. He had a moral view of the world. And he wrote standalone chapter on Aboriginal people in a history ever written in 1952. And he wrote largely about their land relationship, and he was drawing on the work of anthropologists who were writing in the 1930s and 40s about Aboriginal people. He also referred to their land use as productive, which was quite a new way of seeing things. Again, he saw that their way of life would not survive. This is his view, again in 1952, of a progressive person. Agle Shaw, a Melbourne historian who's still alive in his early 90s, wrote The Story of Australia in 1955, very successful book. And he was the first one to move the Aborigines beyond the frontier, because he wrote about them on the frontier. He wrote a few pages about their traditional life, and he actually referred to them as being alive and acting and doing things in the 1930s. I think he talked about the Aboriginal political movement, which we'll talk about later, as arising in the 1930s. Greenwood is the book that I cut my teeth on at university. It was the general history that was used by people, Greenwood's Australia. And yet, it was a regression. It virtually had nothing on Aboriginal people in the book. You wouldn't find them in the index, and I think only the first chapter, which wasn't written by Greenwood, it was a compilation of various historians, the first chapter had a few references to Aboriginal people, but then the rest of the book is silent on them. So this is the book that even though it was written in 55, I was reading it in the mid-60s at university, and teaching out of it at Melbourne University in the early 70s. So that these books have long lives, and sometimes the views that they hold are cultural lags of what was thought about 20 or 30 years before. Pike's book, another one, The Quiet Continent, even the title suggests it's a non-violent history, and that was in fact the view put in his book. And it was only someone like Clark's Short History. Manning Clark did write a number of books in the early 60s. The first volume of his five-volume History of Australia came out, and that said some, I think, curious things about Aboriginal society and culture, and I think basically saw them as static and unchanging, which is a view not shared now. But he, at least in his short history, put Aboriginal faces in his history and right through. And even when the opening of Parliament occurred in 1927 in Canberra, there was an Aboriginal man in his story in the crowd who was wanting to make, I think, some political points about being left out, and he was quietly ushered out of the scene. But at least he's there in Clark's history. So that Aboriginal people were beginning by the 1960s to be written into history. And it was in the 1970s that we had the rise of Aboriginal history. But in fact, it was led by the anthropologists at first, and historians were slow off the mark in writing about Aboriginal people. It was the anthropologists who were going out, talking with Aboriginal communities, who also started to write a bit of the history as background to their ethnographies. And probably Australia's greatest anthropologist, William Stanner, gave the Boyer Lectures, which are the ABC annual lectures, quite prestigious. He gave the Boyer Lectures, I think, in 1958, when he used the word or was it 68? I think it was 68. He used the words, there had been a great Australian silence about Aboriginal people and their role in the nation. And he called on people to bring back Aboriginal people and their stories into the history making. And one man who responded to that was Charles Rowley. He was a person who'd been in Pacific administration as a bureaucrat. He had been to New Guinea as a field officer, and he ran the School of Pacific Administration, which trained field officers in Sydney. And he started a big project to write a three-volume history of Aboriginal people. And it came out in 1972. One was called The Destruction of Aboriginal Society. And they had a huge impact because they were really the first histories that had been written. Now they're a bit old-fashioned, not very much used because it's a big, unwieldy book. It's hard to get into, but it's still a mine of information. So Rowley ignited a lot of people to write PhDs in not a lot, but a dribble of people, you know, half a dozen or whatever, across the country to write PhDs in Aboriginal history. To my regret, I wasn't one of those that chose that. I came into it slightly later. Also, a Journal of Aboriginal History was brought in 1977, so it was creating a discipline of Aboriginal history and a coherence for people to write, to get published, etc. And then, of course, the first, I think, dynamic book in Aboriginal history, The Other Side of the Frontier by Henry Reynolds, which was an attempt to get to the Aboriginal story of the contact. And that's why he chose the title The Other Side of the Frontier. And I was both excited and a bit fearful when I picked up my copy of this book, because I had my own book in press at that time, and I was interested to see what Henry had done. But of course, his was a study of the frontier, a very in-depth, very rich study, and a very exciting book. So that further energised things. But also, so when my book was published, I think I tried to be reflexive even then, even though I hadn't heard the word reflexive at that time. I hope I was trying to do that, because this is what I wrote in the preface of the book in 1982. If we as Australians are to face the future confidently, we must be fully aware of the forces that have shaped the Australian experience. We must know ourselves. The study of Aboriginal history is an important part of that self-knowledge. Through it, we can hope to understand not only the actions and attitudes of Aboriginal Australians, but something of the nature of European Australians as well. Australian history since 1788 has been a story of black and white acting upon and interacting with each other in a great human drama. Yet until recently, the Aborigines rarely appeared in our story, so that we have been presented with half a history, half an Australian experience. And I still really believe in those words today, that we can know a great deal about European Australia by studying Aboriginal history, because it is a shared history and we have to understand, or try and understand, both peoples. And it's not easy for us because both of them are in the past. And people in the past are very different. Even if they might look a bit like us, you'll find they think very differently. And sometimes you'll be thankful for that. So I tried to be reflexive. I think Henry Reynolds has always been oppositional and still is today. And he's written a marvellous oeuvre of about 8 or 9 books. And he's often led the agenda in what he's written. And he's a very admirable historian, but he is oppositional. He believes Aboriginal history is inescapably political, and that's why he's a favourite target in things like the history wars, because he has tried to work against the prevailing discourses and the prevailing ideas. And also, the other way I think we escape Aboriginalism is to be cooperative. And someone like Heather Goodall, whose book we will be reading some chapters of in the early part of this subject, Heather Goodall wrote her PhD very much in conversation with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal groups, and is still doing that today. So I think we're now into a newer phase. We're into now talking with Aboriginal people, people like Deborah Bird Rose, Anne McGrath, who wrote her book Born in the Cattle, did it very much in conversation with Aboriginal people. So historians are seeking Aboriginal feedback on their work. And you can see the shift in my work too. I wrote a brochure for ADSIC in 1990, and it was about Aboriginal people in Victoria. I brought out a new version of that in 2002, and in that new version, I talked very much with Aboriginal people, particularly down at the Koori Heritage Trust. So it was much more cooperatively done than the first one. And this has been a shift, I think, in the work of many historians. And my recent book, Aboriginal Victorians, was done with the help of over 20 Aboriginal people who I interviewed and re-interviewed and had their cooperation. And my next project will be to write a history of the Aboriginal Youth Advancement League. And I've been talking, I haven't started yet, but I've been talking with the League for a year and a half about writing the history, and we've been getting their records in order. And they're just about to go down to the State Library to be catalogue indexed and things. So historians are now very much talking with Aboriginal people about the histories they're writing. And so they're starting in the other phase of listening to Aboriginal people, because they are making history themselves now in so many ways. They're not so much writing the big books yet, although there have been one or two, but mostly they're writing history through their own life stories, and that's something that you know you could choose to study in some of your essays if you wanted to. They're making films. Of course, there have been films for some time. I'll be showing a couple of excerpts of the Women of the Sun series that was made 25 years ago. But there's a new series about to hit the SBS airways next year, which will be called The First Australians, a six-part series made by Blackfella Films, which is an Aboriginal film unit in Sydney with Aboriginal producers and things. Although they're working cooperatively with non-Aboriginal historians, there is this shared effort going on. So history making now is very much a shared enterprise between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. So the major themes in Aboriginal history have been, first of all, putting Aboriginal people into the story, and secondly, first of all, I think talking about the frontier and talking about the violence that was often understated, for instance, in the book The Quiet Continent, which suggested Australia had no violence in its history, putting that version back into it, exploring Aboriginal agency, that is Aboriginal activeness, how they participated in the encounters with settlers, and researching the themes of Aboriginal accommodation. You know, how did Aboriginal people respond to Western culture? How did they respond to Christianity, etc., etc.? And writing that story, and then writing a shared history. And very recently, because of, you must have heard of the history wars, writing or rewriting again the story of frontier violence. Now, all of this, of course, has caused a backlash. I suppose you've heard of Geoffrey Blainey? Anyone heard of Geoffrey Blainey?
Yes.
He's an Australian historian, and he's a historian actually of great significance. He's written some fantastic books. He's actually, when you meet him personally, a very, very nice bloke. But he has a particular view, and he expressed that in the Latham Lecture in 1993, in which he identified there were two different schools of Australian history, he said. First of all, the Three Cheers School and the Black Armband School. So then he gave an assessment of them. He said, the Three Cheers School, let's look at it. One cheer, he said, Australia was an economic success story. Despite the most arid continent in the world, we'd been able to make it work in terms of agriculture, etc., pastoralism, and fed 100 million people and put jumpers on their back. And he said Aboriginal people had only supported 1 million. He also talked about the mineral wealth of Australia that had been exploited, and he knew so much about that because he wrote some very good mining histories of Australia as a young historian, a commissioned historian. And he said, but unfortunately the economic success had gone into recent decline, mismanagement, the work ethic, etc. I think that was very much a comment on Labor politics of the 1980s rather than perhaps an assessment. The second thing, environmentally, he said we'd buggered up the environment big time and done it in about five or six generations. So it was now one of the most damaged environments because the economic success had meant we'd beaten the hell out of the country by working it too hard, overstocking it, etc., etc. But he did see in politics and democracy that we had created now the oldest democracy in the world, and that's something to be enormously proud of in his mind. And we were, the first national electorate to give votes to women. So what he ends up in saying is Australia should get two cheers, not three cheers. One for the economic success, one for democracy, but none for the environment. But then he looked at the black armband history, and of course his view was that too many historians were writing in a mournful way, with a black armband metaphorically on their arms, that they're writing about the bad things and stressing the bad things in our culture. And he said, on commenting on that, that there was a great gulf between Aboriginal and European society, he believed, that forming a treaty was an impossibility. It was an inevitable that the hunting and gathering society would fade away in the face of Western society. That disease really was the big killer on the frontier, and it's true that it was. And finally, he said that traditional society was very violent, and probably more Aborigines had killed each other in the 18th century than were killed by Europeans in the 19th century. So he's pushing a particular view. But he says, on balance, Australia is a success story and we shouldn't dwell on the negatives. Now, of course, this suited the views of a historian, politician called John Howard, who took up the slogan of Black Armband, history in 1996. He wanted us to imagine an Australia that was comfortable and optimistic rather than one dwelling on the dismal things of the past. John Howard said there'd been too much navel-gazing and that was creating guilt and shame in the community, and he wanted a history that was optimistic and national history. And so this is part of his push for Australian history in schools that's going on at the very moment, that there should be, the national story should be taught, and it should be taught with pride. Now, this, I think, encouraged the history wars that developed around 2000. A person, Keith Windschuttle, who's not quite a historian, he was more a social policy academic, denied that there was a violent frontier, and in fact the British Empire was a good empire ruled by law and order, and these things were impossible, and historians had exaggerated the violence. And he wrote a series of articles in the Journal Quadrant, which is a conservative think tank journal, and this led to a massive debate rolling across the country, at times very acrimonious between historians. It was supported by the Prime Minister, who opened the new offices of Quadrant. I think at that office it was also announced that ASIO had been supported by American intelligence in its funding, and Quadrant had as well. So there was some quite interesting revelations going on. Windschuttle went on to write a book called The Fabrication of Aboriginal History, a very aggressive title. He was basically saying that all other historians writing about Tasmanian history had made things up, had lied and fabricated things. Now, he certainly found some errors in their work, and we should all strive to get every footnote exact and accurate. But it was a very acrimonious debate, and Lyndall Ryan, who hadn't touched her thesis for 30 years, had to go back through her thesis notes trying to desperately find where those errors might be. But basically his view, while it had some good history, also was driven by a very unsympathetic view of Aboriginal society. For instance, he made one claim that Aboriginal people didn't fight for land because they didn't have a word for land, and that they were mainly raiding settlers to get goods, so they were more like criminals rather than patriots. So it's a very strong view, and of course there were reactions from other historians, people, and also people like Rob Mann at this organisation, who wrote or edited a book called Whitewash. So that there we have the nature of history making in Australia about Aboriginal people. And I suppose the balance sheet approach to me doesn't quite work. I think we can't add up the past and say, look, you know, we've got two things good, one thing bad, so let's just talk about the good. I think we can do both things at once. I think we can talk about the very good things in our society, and we have many of them, many of things to be proud. And I hope every time you stick your ballot paper in and an election, you think of the people who fought for that right in the past, going right back to the Charters in England. It's a very precious right that we have, and we should protect it and be fiercely protected. But in our society, we have done some things less well, and we need to talk about them as well, because to go back to my preface, we can't really understand ourselves if we just continue to talk about the good things, about Anzac, about Federation and whatever, and we don't talk about other aspects of our past.